your beard is really coming on.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you want to touch it?
No.
Go, do you want to touch it?
No.
That makes me feel weird.
Really? Keep in your pants, big boy.
First you want to kill me, now you want to kiss me. Blow.
Hey, you've got 3 seconds for it.
I'm going to amp this baby up, see how it sounds.
That's the worst fucking sweater I've ever seen. It's a Cosby sweater. A Cosby sweater.
And this is the FakeChimp.net podcast. My name's Glenn.
I'm Jarrett.
I'm Sean.
And thank you for listening. Of course, you can find us on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher. Catch us on Facebook, all that kind of shit. I want to talk to Jarrett about his travels. He's been away.
I have.
New York and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Come back with
anything. Don't call Texas whatnot. Texas is its own state.
Stars are bright.
It's a big state, but you can travel one end to the other in about 8.5 hours, I believe.
Yeah, it's about, yeah. If you're driving at the speed of light.
You're not stopping.
So we'll get to the whatnot soon, but New York.
New York was great. I don't think I'd ever travel to the United States, well, particularly New York again in winter. It was fucking cold. It took about 20 minutes to get dressed in the morning. You were layering up.
How cold are we talking here?
Talking about -5 degrees Celsius. That was about as cold as got as I was out, and we got a bit of snow, but luckily we got out before the massive snowstorm where they had like 7 feet of snow. We were out that morning.
But it's a little bit romantic, isn't it? You're walking with your wife or your girl, arm in arm, her cheeks are rosy, you got coffee in your hand.
For about 10 minutes, it's beautiful. And then you're
such a fucking pussy, seriously.
And then you got to get out of it.
What's the coldest you've been in?
Well, I lived in Vancouver, so it would have been minus 18, probably got the coldest.
Balmy Scottish day. Yes. Scotland's the only place I've ever lived where you wake up and it's so cold there's ice on the inside of the fucking windows.
Do you remember that feeling when you step outside and literally the blood inside your face freezes?
Drains out. Yeah, it's crazy.
Absolutely amazing.
Now, I did mention to Sean earlier that it felt like my eyes were like bleeding. I've honestly never been in an
Did
environment.
You say like,
I've never been to the
locals?
Snow before.
You've never been to the snow?
I've never been to the snow. No, the only time I've seen snow prior to this trip to New York was last time I was in New York. No, probably about 4 years ago. Yeah,
really?
When it snowed in New York in November, and I was like, oh wow, so we saw the snow, and then it was good for about 2 hours, and then we're like, enough of this snow.
Well, this is fucking miserable.
I don't
Let's
know if,
go
yeah,
home.
I, you know, if I, I would like to go to the snow with the intention of doing something like tobogganing.
Did
is
you
that
build did tobogganing?
Is that a little thing you get on?
Yeah, a sled,
a
toboggan.
Yeah. A little sled?
Did you build a snowman at the very least?
No, there wasn't enough snow to do that. You know, it was just hobo.
There wasn't
a
enough.
Why. I couldn't tell what was glass. And
but I want to hear all about. I want to hear all about whatnot.
Yeah,
the
Texas.
Whatnot. In Texas, we took a bit of a road trip about 2 hours out of Austin and went and visited the house from the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Ooh la la.
Yeah, and we saw. We had breakfast there, which was quite cool. It was just like real film geekery
They capitalize on the Texas Chainsaw Massacre
to
geekness.
A degree. Yeah, absolutely. Like in the menu, they had a little thing that said, you know, if you're after any Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know, souvenirs, speak to your waiting staff. And some of the waiting staff were wearing Texas Chainsaw Massacre t-shirts, but it did, this is a point of contention. It had the tagline from the original film, Who Will Survive, not the full tagline.
Mm.
But on the back, it had the Texas Chainsaw Massacre title. But the title treatment was for the 2003 fucking film.
Blasphemous.
Which really annoyed me. And I almost felt like I should tell them, but they don't care.
What
but no,
have?
I did come up with a slogan for the restaurant, which was, who will survive and what will be fed to them.
Good.
So yeah, if I'm ever back in Texas, I'm going to put that in the suggestion
box. Did the menu have items relating to the
No, film? Unfortunately not. No, but we did have the chicken fried steak. And afterward, when Danny had the same dish as me, she said to me, pretty sure that wasn't chicken. I go, no, that was beef in that, baby. It was like, it was fried like chicken with a chicken sort of layer, but it's beef inside. But I'm not 100% sure it was beef either. It could have been human flesh, human beef.
Yes.
Yeah. Nice. But yeah, no, that's one of the stories. And yeah, I got around to a lot of cinemas, saw a fair few films. Because I mean, what else do you do when you're my age and it's late at night and you still want to kind of be out but not out?
Yeah.
Yeah. You can't find
any drug dealers. You know, what else do you do?
Get a hit. I'd make a trip to the movies. One of the highlights of Austin was finally getting to visit the Alamo Draft House.
Oh my god, how good is the Alamo?
An experience unlike any other. Absolutely
unlike
incredible.
Any other.
Unlike any other experience at the movies. It's kind of the equivalent of Gold Class, but if you were going to see effective, like, big movies.
It's Gold Class for people who aren't schmucks.
Yeah.
Seriously, it is. Right, it's Gold Class because the Alamo, for those of you who don't know, the Alamo is a cinema that is very obviously run by film cinephiles.
Yeah.
Like, they know their stuff inside out, back to front. They know what's going to play. They know what's not going to play. They know where they can push it and pull it. And it is the most extraordinary cinema you're ever going to visit. And I saw Gremlins on Christmas Eve at the Alamo last year.
Amazing.
And it was
jealous.
I saw Titanic, but they recut the film from 3 hours down to 90 minutes.
Amazing.
And then changed some of the music cues in it and changed some of the soundtrack completely. It was this Austin comedy troupe riffing on it all the way through it, like
is
Mystery
it a
Science Theater.
Better film?
It was. I enjoyed it. Like, it had been a number of years since I'd seen it, but I really enjoyed watching it in this kind of context.
Does it Does it still sink?
Yeah, unfortunately so, yeah. Right. Yeah, but no, the funny thing was they did cut the iceberg constantly throughout the film and play like a Jaws sound cue. So it was always coming. Like, I think you would see it every now and again.
Good.
Brilliant. But yeah, no, so it was a great trip. So what else have you guys been up to in the past month?
I turned into an outdoorsman, that's it. I went camping with my brother.
I
grew a beard. I put up a tent, cooked food on a fire.
On a trangie or?
What?
Oh, no, you actually did.
What the hell, a trangie?
Yeah, you know, a trangie. It's like a little gas, you know, thing. And
Oh, good gas. No, no, like, stove. Guys,
yeah,
come on.
Yeah, a tiny little trangie thing.
Bear Grylls would be
trangie.
Jealous.
What the fuck is a trangie? Yeah. I camp and I don't know what a trangie is.
Oh, maybe it's a Queensland thing. I don't know.
I don't know. Just a fire. Just a fire. That was it. That's and work. That's all I've done.
Yeah. And me, I've just been enjoying the new year for what it is. Cataloging lots of films and...
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well played.
Watching lots of...
And you've been going to a lot of screenings. I've noticed the reviews have been popping up on the site. You're going to a lot of previews and...
Yeah, just catching what I can.
Yep.
Yeah, for sure. Keeping the content fresh.
Any particular standouts from what you've gone and seen recently?
Probably Room.
With Brie Larson?
Yeah. Huge. Knockout huge film. Raps. Is it
now,
really?
This is probably a good knockout. Film to take the lady
you mean
on
you haven't
on
read
Valentine's Day?
No, I've read it.
You know, it's a bit of a rom-com.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah,
maybe. Right. It's very romantic.
Agoraphobics?
No, it's very romantic for all those pedophiles out there.
Yeah, right.
No, great film.
You're really going to like it in Room.
Great film. No. Okay, well, speaking of Room, the Oscar nominations dropped.
Yep. What do we think?
So, well, let's read out the movies that are nominated for those people playing at home. Got The Big Short, Bridge of Spies, Joy, Mad Max Fury Road, Brooklyn, The Martian, Room, The Revenant, and Spotlight.
Just a stupid amount of films.
Fucking stupid amount.
Just ridiculous.
How many of these films have you seen, Glenn? I reckon you've seen...
I have seen them all except for Brooklyn.
Right.
I think everybody's seen them all except
for Brooklyn.
Oh
yeah, Brooklyn hasn't opened yet.
No.
Brooklyn doesn't open until February sometime.
No.
Yeah.
And it doesn't even really... It's Stephen Frears, yeah?
It is Stephen Frears.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, I didn't realise that.
Yeah, which is connected to our focus.
Interesting.
But it doesn't grab me. The trailer's very boring.
Yeah.
What
was the name of the actress? The girl from How I Live Now?
She's kind of cool.
The Irish Bird.
Saoirse Ronan or something?
I don't even know how to pronounce it.
She's probably nominated for an Academy. So if she wins it, we'll know her name.
Yeah, that's right. We probably still won't be able to pronounce it.
I know. Give it to John Travolta. Watch him fuck it up.
Well, maybe her name's so fucked up, he'll get it right.
He might. You never know.
Yeah, but look, you know, there's too many films, but I think The Martian is sticking out like a sore thumb. That does not belong in the Oscar nomination for Best Picture.
It's an entertaining movie, but at the end of the day, it really is a bit of a popcorn movie.
It's a slutty film.
Is.
You know, it's not
Well, hang on. Didn't it win an award in the Best Comedy category?
Well, that was the only thing, because I think there was no room left in drama, so they put it in Best Comedy or Musical.
There's no room left in drama, so let's just call it a comedy.
I know, but it was comedy or musical, and... There was a lot of disco music in The Martian.
Okay. but the comedy that was in The Martian was very significant to his survival. Like,
yeah.
It wasn't a
to
comedy
his psyche.
Film.
Yeah.
No, absolutely.
And even to Ridley Scott's eternal credit, I know Ridley's been hit and miss, but I've got a soft spot for him. To his eternal credit, when he accepted the BAFTA?
Yeah, I think
the BAFTA,
it was.
He took the award, and basically all he said was, thanks very much, best comedy, I don't know, but thanks anyway. Yeah. And then walked away again. So he knows how ridiculous it is to be crowbarred in, for the sake of it. So
I definitely don't think it fits this collection of films.
No.
What about like Matt Damon for Best Actor? How do you feel like that? No,
definitely not. Good performance.
Yeah, great performance. Yeah, but
yeah, I didn't think he would be able to hold a film like that for, you know, a film that's primarily one character.
Yeah.
I think he did an exceptional job with it. Yeah, I don't know if he deserves.
I honestly think that Leo will take it out this year.
Can't wait to see this. I'm going to go see Revenant tomorrow.
Yeah.
Danny's more excited about seeing this film than me, but I am excited.
Yeah, yeah.
You really should. I mean, like, I was the same. Even if we think back to the last podcast, even I said, Aronofsky's films, like, I don't know. So I went to see it purely, pretty much based on Glenn's review, saying the cinematography, and I went in to see it. Honestly, if it had been released on December 31st last year, best film of the year.
Right.
Staggering. Wow. I couldn't be more impressed. You're going to love it.
Excellent. No, I can't wait.
And yet, best film of the year went to Mad Max for you.
Mino.
And that's up for the nomination as well.
Well, because Mad Max was released last year and The Revenant was released this year.
I'm so confused right now. I thought he said he'd like it if it was released on December
31st. No, I know what he was saying. It would have made his list last year.
Oh, it would have made your top 10.
Yeah, it would have been my number one. Yeah.
Wow. Well, there you go. Well, does that mean you hope that wins over Mad Max?
Wow. See, this is the thing.
Because I think Mad Max is a far more innovative film.
I agree.
A far more interesting film, whereas The Revenant is a great film, but it is very simple, very basic.
It is the most simple of human stories. But, you know, it's a survival film.
Yeah.
Like, he is the rabbit and the hare at the same time. Yeah. And
it's an endurance kind of performance. So I think, performance wise, there's no doubt that he probably deserves it.
Mm.
You know, compared to everything else that's nominated, I think so.
Yeah, I agree. And I think as far as the Oscars go, Best Picture is going to come down to Mad Max or The Revenant. I think
my money's on Mad Max, but I wouldn't be surprised if Revenant. I think
The Revenant. I haven't even seen it, but it's just the feeling. Absolutely.
And 2 years in a row, you know, after Birdman, it wouldn't surprise me either because the momentum's there.
I agree.
But look, you know, Spotlight is a great film.
Yeah, look, it was a good film, but honestly, it was a good film.
I've heard the same thing. I haven't seen it yet.
Did you notice my review?
It was amazing performance.
I said in my review that it's not a good looking film. It's such a bare bones basic film. It all takes place in an office. There's nothing creative about shooting an office. Mm. You know, it's essentially all the President's Men updated for today.
Yeah.
So performance wise, it's great. But it's really Michael Keaton's great.
I thought they were good performances. I didn't think anyone was particularly standout in the film.
Tell you who I think should get an award. I don't know if he's nominated. He's the little boy from Room. That movie I was talking about before.
No, I don't think he is.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, when occasionally you get these child prodigies come along and they knock, like Anna Paquin with the piano and all these, Haley Joel Osment, you know, this is another kid that's just, you know, way better than what he should be. He's sort of got a really mature performance. Yeah, I reckon he might take something.
Real well.
If he's nominated.
Is Tom Hardy's nominated for The Revenant?
I hope
Best
not.
Supporting?
Terrible.
Really? Is he terrible in The Revenant?
Yeah, read my review. I didn't love him in it.
Right, okay, yeah.
You take that back.
Well, he was Tom Hardy being Tom Hardy.
I know, but that's okay.
And he needs subtitles again.
He's had a really fucking packed year, hasn't he?
He has.
Yes, hasn't he? Yeah.
Legend, Mad Max, The Revenant.
He wasn't bad in the film, and his character has its place, but I don't think he stood up against Leo very well. I think the two of them.
See, this is the thing. Is like I'm going to be shot down, and I'm probably going to lose a few fans that I might actually have. I don't rate Leo.
Don't you?
No. At all as an actor, or in The Revenant in particular.
No, just like to be honest, I think Leo is the best of one of the best of the bunch we have just now. But the problem is, the bunch we have just now aren't very good.
I will agree there that the caliber of actor now is not the same as it was 20 years ago.
No, absolutely not.
But I do think he's an actor of a generation. I really do.
I don't. I think he plays the same guy every single time.
At all.
I think he's an exceptional actor. Yeah.
Until The Revenant. The Revenant is the first time where I look at him and I think that's a man, as opposed to that's a boy pretending to be a man.
See, it was The Departed that did that for me. That was the film that made me think, well, you're a man now.
Like, there is a film that does that for everybody. Because I was, including Gangs in New York, he just wasn't quite there for me as an adult actor.
He's always been that way to me. And The Revenant is the first time I look at him and think, that's a man who has a man's responsibility and he understands a man's place in the world.
Yeah.
Up until now, like even you go to like Django, with this kind of wispy, terrible, wafy beard. And
I really liked
him. He just looked like a boy.
I thought he
pretending to be a man.
Yeah, but back then as well, like, you were a man much younger back then.
Yeah, he was a young sort of plantation owner in that, so I think that made sense.
He's not a bad actor. I think he's a great star. I don't necessarily think he's a great actor.
I've always liked him, but I think it was Inception.
I think Inception was when I actually took note and went, you know what, maybe fuck this guy is good. And then when I revisited a lot of the films, I went, oh wow, I can't believe that, you know, I've never had such a high opinion of you, but you are.
Hasn't it been an interesting evolution? Because, I mean, firstly, you had Gilbert Grape is what, turned a lot of people.
I revisited that recently. So good.
Yes, but then...
Look at your face.
But then after that, right, because he still had, like, a lot of people still hung shit on him, but then he did the Basketball Diaries.
Yes.
And that changed a lot of people. Every step of his career, he's brought new people in, you know?
And he's kept doing... smart, like, good movies. Like, he hasn't really, as far as I can remember, he hasn't done a romantic comedy or anything like that. He's just
outside
done
of perhaps his appearance in Celebrity, Woody Allen's Celebrity, which is pushing 20 years ago now. Name me a bad Leo film.
I never saw that. I reckon Dom's Plum either.
Don's Plum. Yeah,
yeah. I never saw that one.
Neither did I. That was the one they tried to sort of sweep under the carpet. But that notwithstanding, for a guy who's been in the film industry for 25 years, to not even have a, like...
Critters 3, right?
Well, hang on, though.
But I mean, like, even at a Leo film, at worst, is still a three-star event.
Yeah, and that's worth watching.
Absolutely.
Actually, I think that my least favourite is probably The Aviator, but it's still a good film.
It's still a three-star film. I totally agree. The guy hasn't made a bad film. So,
All right. Well, let's move this baby on.
Cool.
Oh, hang on. Can I just mention one film that should be in the Best Picture category? Because, you know, we've got 8 fucking films. We could squeeze one more in there. Mona Lisa, which is the new Charlie Kaufman film. Stop motion, boundary pushing, brilliant human drama. Should be nominated for Best Picture. Is nominated for Best Animated Feature. Yeah. Up again, Inside Out. It's a fucking travesty. And it breaks my heart.
There's so many double standards when it comes to Best Film. You know, it should not be, you know, restricted to just... live action, you know, or any particular genre, which is why I hope Bad Max wins, because it might open up the, you know, the selective process a bit more to genre films. You know, if there's a great genre film, why can't that be nominated for Best Film? Because it's a film.
Yeah, precisely. Right?
Exactly.
I couldn't agree more.
You know, like, back when Toy Story came out, that should have been up for Best Picture.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know? And every now and then they let, like, a foreign film get in. Australia makes films which are considered foreign to the American audience, and we can get in every now and then.
Yeah,
you know, so I don't know. It's just fucked up.
No, it's the contradictions in the Oscars has always been my biggest gripe with it. And like I've said it before, like how can you have best film but have a different best director? Just doesn't make sense. Just doesn't make sense.
But then again, it's the Oscars, and you take it with a grain of salt. The Coen brothers weighed in on that this week because you had the whole controversy over, you know, black actors boycotting the Oscars and whatnot, and they weighed into it somehow and just said, but it's just the actors, you know, you can't write films specifically for, you know, certain demographics if it doesn't fit the story. Yeah, like, absolutely. You know, and yeah, anyway, going off on a tangent now.
No, makes sense. What
fucking hand guy? That's
a film I haven't seen in a long time.
Forrest Gump?
No, fuck Forrest Gump.
No, don't fuck Forrest Gump. That's good. Same year, Shawshank.
Forrest Gump film.
I don't think fucking Forrest Gump. I remember my dad taking me to see Forrest Gump, and for some reason, inexplicably, whenever I think of Forrest Gump, I think of Bryan Adams.
Because of the tree?
No, because Bryan Adams had the number one song.
Everything, whatever it was for Robin Hood.
Yeah. So they all kind of came out.
That Robin Hood song was like 92, and Forrest Gump was like 94.
Yeah. Well, I know, Bryan Adams was in the top 10 for about 8 fucking years with that song. Don't Want DeMarco.
The song, you know, have you ever really ever loved a woman?
Was it that song?
Yeah.
No, whatever it was.
It might have been that one.
Can't believe you just pulled that out of thin air.
I know.
And knew it.
Oh, that song?
Yeah.
I don't know. I knew what movie it was from.
I've never seen it. Is it any good?
Never saw it.
Alright, so Valentine's Day is coming up. No?
Yeah. Was that you putting on your crooner voice?
No.
Michael Bublé, eat your fucking heart out.
The Valentine's Day is coming up.
That sounds more like it.
So we thought we'd visit a bit of a... Would you call this a romantic classic? No. Rom-com, yes.
Rom-com, yeah. Perhaps.
Rom-com drama.
Perhaps the greatest breakup film.
Of all time.
Everybody, yeah. Well, what's your top five?
Ah, well, let's go with High Fidelity.
That'd be my number one.
Number one.
There you go.
Cool. So I was really glad we chose this one at the end. We put out a few there to choose from, and this is what we ended up with. It is, in my mind, a near-perfect film. I think it is absolutely phenomenal.
I think it is a perfect film.
There you go.
And it's staggering to think that it's now 16 years old.
Wow.
That, 16 years old.
That frightens me to no end.
I saw this at the movies, yeah.
Same.
My sister and I went and saw this in American Psycho at the movies.
Yeah, 2000, yeah. Of course.
And every now and then you get these films like this that come along, and when you watch it, you just know how good it is. What the fuck was that noise?
What was that, Glenn? Oh, it was you.
For a second, I thought Jarrett farted.
It was the microphone.
It was John Cusack.
Just ground everything to a halt.
Oh, right. So, okay, how do we bring it back?
How about that
16 years ago, every so often, there's a film that comes along.
Yes. That just, you know, you're watching it, that this is going to have longevity, you know?
Yeah.
And I knew I'd be able to go back to this one every few months and just get the same enjoyment out of it. And it still does. It still really, really works on me.
And I think part of the reason it works as well as it does is Stephen Frears, to be honest. Like, because he directs it, there's nothing flashy about the way he directs it. It's a very pragmatic approach. And with that, it means that the style and the aesthetic of the film can endure because you're not relying on tricks of the trade that are hot at the time.
I agree.
Do you know what I mean?
It's soaked in style.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's nice and elegant. It's simple. The camera's just used as a tool to tell the story.
And that means it ages well too.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. Like, it has a longevity. Yeah. And thank God he did, because like you say, this is one of the ones, I watch this probably once a year. Yeah. I can almost quote it verbatim. It's amazing.
And of course, the other reason it works so well is because it's so relatable. Like, he talks directly to you.
Oh yeah, direct.
And his problems are your problems. Like, everyone knows what it's like to be fanatical about something, like whether it's a music collection, movie collection, or a hobby or whatever. Yeah. And he relates that to his relationship. And I think everyone can really tap into what he's talking about.
Yeah. And but more than that, I mean, like, you know, outside of just that kind of geeky value that just about everybody has at their core somewhere, somehow, whether, you know, my girlfriend Mary, she loves makeup, she geeks out over makeup, I geek out over films, my, you know, my best mate geeks out over music. Everybody has had, well, almost everybody has had one of those relationships that he talks about.
Yeah.
And that's the crux of the film, is that every single person that watches it, guy or girl, can relate to it at an emotional level. And that's why it lasts. And that's why we keep going back to it, because every single time there's something new in a different part of your life where you can watch it and think, I've been there, I've done that. And it's great.
Well, let's talk about the fact that the film was adapted with an American setting when the book itself was set in London. I can't even imagine this being British. Like, it's really hard for me to comprehend this story being told in a British way.
Dang,
haven't read the book, so I don't know. And from what we could gather watching interviews earlier, just the research, we're watching interviews with the director, and, you know, the book sounds to me like it's very London-centric.
Mm.
That's hard to comprehend.
It is, because you watch this film, and it paints a beautiful picture of Chicago. There's so much Chicago iconography within the film. It's a key element. It's one of the lead stars in the film. So, yeah, to transpose this and put it back in London, it would be near impossible.
British accents, British music, and it'd be a whole...
Well, on that note, like, John Cusack, exceptional. I mean, he was on a run of great films around the time. He'd done Gross Point Blank, and I think he did Serendipity.
Which he was producing these at the time, so he was really creatively involved. He wrote this one. He wrote Gross Point Blank with the same writer from this one. So he was obviously in a really creative, a really good creative space at the time.
And he obviously picked stories, you know, like, well, this is a character I can play. I can draw upon my own experience. And having watched some of those interviews we watched earlier with John Cusack, him relate to talking about the music and that. So you could see that there's so much of him that is written into this adaptation, this script.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that makes it even more relatable on screen.
But he's one of the driving forces that transposition of, you know, London to Chicago. He's one of the driving forces. And again, it's one of those, when you watch it, It's obviously Chicago. Like, it looks like Chicago.
Yeah.
But it's Chicago from somebody who knows Chicago.
Like a John Hughes film. It's just
exactly right. Yeah, yeah. It's like it's not so on the nose like a Spike Lee film. It's just, it's very comfortable in what it is, where it is. Yeah. This is obviously people who have grown up in this environment their entire life. Almost to a degree, although the genre is completely different. Ben Affleck with Gone Baby Gone.
Yeah.
It's obviously like he knows, you know, and Google Hunting. Yeah. He knows this place, and there's not. Yeah. It's really homely and warm, and it's gorgeous.
All of the locations are very specific, but you can tell they've got a history with the people behind the film. Yeah. You know, you're very familiar to them because it's so comfortable.
Yeah.
You know?
And now obviously because you've worked behind the counter as well.
Yeah.
You know, in the day, and I've worked behind the counter. Yeah. Granted, more in home entertainment than record stores. But how relatable is the experience of everything from, you know, thieves in store to, you know, the kind of customers you get that to no end will annoy you? It's so true to form.
And that sense of superiority to them.
When absolutely. Yeah. The elitism.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It just sort of resonates on all levels. But I think even as a customer, you've all been in that shop where you've got that douchebag behind the counter. Oh, no, you know?
All too well.
You can relate from either side of it.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so good. Go on.
What I was going to say was like that relatability even extends to things. I would challenge you next time you watch it again, right? You go back, just take a look at things like the production design, right? Take a look at things like the costume design.
There is
nothing in this film that an ordinary 30-something or mid-20, 30-something can't relate to. His apartment looks like my apartment.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like some bullshit Brooklyn loft where some guy who runs a record store is rolling in millions of dollars. It looks homely and it looks like a patchwork of things he's collected over the 10 years he's lived out of home. His clothes don't match. He's not styled by Gucci. He's got a fucking terrible dress sense.
Yeah.
But we all have fucking terrible dress. We don't all walk about looking like we just walked out of a Prada advert.
Yeah, sure.
And that relatability just seeps into every single aspect of this film. It's, oh my God.
Now the important question, Evil Dead 2 better than Evil Dead?
it is a film I refer to all the time when I talk about Evil Dead with new customers when I've been talking to them at the store and they ask me if it's any good.
Yeah.
And we had that conversation. You can always throw to High Fidelity.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Which I believe in one of the European countries, might not even be European, it might be Russia, I'm not sure.
Right.
That's been translated to Reservoir Dogs. They don't talk about Evil Dead. They talk about Reservoir Dogs because Evil Dead 2 is not known over there.
Right. That's crazy, though. Weird. But it's like, you know, we're talking sequels here.
I know.
Really odd. But anyway.
You can't say it's Reservoir Dogs 1 better than Pulp Fiction or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
What about Jack Black? This was the film. Yeah. Jack Black had been kicking around for a little while beforehand. Saw popping up in little bits. You know, The Jackal, I Still Need Last Summer, you know, like a couple of street.
That's right. The Rasnafani.
The Rasnafani.
I loved it in that.
But this was the film. Without this, we wouldn't be, arguably, wouldn't have the Jack Black. You understand?
Well, it gave us the character Jack Black.
That's true.
Because before this, he was doing serious films like The Fan. Mm-hmm. And to an extent, The Cable Guy, he was serious in
it. It was a dark comedy, and he played a pretty serious
we
role.
We didn't know Jack Black, this overly animated, you know, ka-ka kind of guy.
Absolutely.
And all of a sudden, this film gave us that, and he hasn't really dropped the facade since.
No, I know.
I still love Jack Black. I think he does what he does really well.
I think he has a voice.
It's saturation, right?
Yeah.
But in High Fidelity, he was born to play that role.
Absolutely.
It is where Jack Black shines. He's absolutely perfect.
And he almost steals the scene. Every time he's in the shot, you can't take your eyes off of him.
He's quotable. Like, I mean, he's
he is the quotable parts of the film.
He came up with a Cosby sweater. You know, like, that's fantastic when he does that line. When he does his Walking on Sunshine dance, tell me you don't try that dance when that song comes on or think about it.
Yeah.
You know,
And he was one of the actors that Cusack said that they had their eye on from a script level.
They wrote it for him.
Wanted. And Frears was like, looked at him and immediately was like, yeah, I'll just let him do what he does.
Yep.
And I was in awe.
Yeah.
So, he was great. And it was really the birth of the comedy Jack Black that we know in cinema now.
Yeah.
Which obviously people over in Hollywood already knew that character because he'd been doing Tenacious D for a few years.
He had
popped up in Biodome, for Christ's sake, doing that kind of stuff. But obviously these people knew he had it in him and they wrote the dialogue. It's obviously written for that sensibility. Outlandish Jack Black. So good.
I always liked it because so often romantic comedies, romantic dramas, whatever the case may be, more often than not, there are exceptions to the rule, of course, but more often than not, they tend to be geared more towards women and, you know, their situation. Yeah. Where this is a romantic film told from a guy's point of view. Mm. But more of that, it's a romantic comedy told from a guy's point of view where the guy he's a bit of a dick.
He's flawed.
Yeah, he's a bit of a moron most of the time. And then all the women that do come into his life, you know, all those women that he does go back and he try, you know, traces back the relationships that's with, all the women, they're not schmucks.
No.
They're all savvy and they're all smart and they're all intelligent. And if we can just mention some of the names of the women that appear in this.
Sure.
Catherine Zeta-Jones, Lisa Bonet, Lily Taylor. The list just goes on and on and on. And they're all superb. Yeah. They're all amazing in them. And they're not there to be sex icons. They're not there to be used, abused, made fun of, or anything like that. If anything, they're the ones taking the piss out of the guy.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, we still love them. Yeah. We love them all. Yeah. It's like such a clever dynamic. For sure. I really enjoy it.
And the clever what you said before, each of those characters will resonate and someone will connect to it from the audience point of view.
Yeah, exactly.
You might not know all those characters that you've experienced in real life, you know, connect to those, but one of those women you will identify with in some way or another.
Completely.
You know, as someone in your own life.
Yeah.
I sure as hell hope it's not Catherine Zeta-Jones because she's an absolute cow.
She is a cow. Film.
Stunning, though.
Stunning cow.
Yeah.
Awesome
it's
side
cow nonetheless.
Awesome side boob.
As far as cows go, she's one of the best.
Yeah, that's true. When she walks across the room doing that click, rub, yeah. It's like, oh my god. I really want to get nasty right now.
Yeah, right.
But in
but you digress.
Yeah,
you
digress. Yeah, but back on track.
Right, we're talking about casting. We talked about Jack Black. I can't remember the guy's name. The guy who played Dick, the bald
sidekick.
Baldy.
Who is the exact opposite, the polar opposite of Jack Black.
Yeah. Mm. This is another stroke of
subtlety.
Yeah, yeah.
Subtlety versus Jack.
I disagree that anyone could have played this role. This guy was born for this role as well.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've ever seen his work elsewhere, it's nothing like this.
He always plays a secret agent.
Yeah.
He's always in a suit.
Playing something really serious in a suit, like you said. And in this one, he plays a real introverted character and I think it's almost like the dialogue was written for him as well.
Mm. Yeah.
It wasn't. Mm. He just sort of sunk into it really, really well. And playing against the three of them as a trio, brilliant.
Yeah, it just
the
works.
The dynamic is incredible.
Yeah, it just works.
You know, there's a pecking order to them as well.
Yeah,
absolutely.
No, you've got him, then you've got Jack Black, then you've got John Cusack, and there's that
John
authority.
Cusack is in the middle, and these two are on the polar outside edges of the spectrum.
So what do we think of Hoodie and the Blowfish?
Had their time, not so much anymore.
What do you think about the lead singer being in the film?
You guys are snobs.
Because we're talking about an environment here where the music's respected.
Yeah.
And you bring Hootie and the Blowfish into the shop.
But then they also bring the boss.
But he's very respected.
That's what I mean,
yeah. But that's what I mean. This is the polar opposites again.
The Hootie and the Blowfish were, by this time, they were big before this.
They were pretty big.
Had they run their course at the time?
I think they had. I feel like they had.
If they weren't, then they were probably
about
the end of
95.
So the Counting Crows took over, or was that the same era?
it is an odd decision, but maybe it's one of those kind of bands like Bare Naked Ladies that, you know, somewhere else are appreciated for a wider body of work, there's two fucking songs, and that was it.
In some alternate universe, they're still producing number
somewhere,
ones.
Someone likes Chumbawamba for more than Tub Thumping, and it just blows my mind.
That's true, and they're still fucking touring, and they can get away with that shit.
If we can talk about the longevity of High Fidelity, is there any time you guys have watched it and the credits have rolled and you press stop and then you didn't turn around and start creating your own top five lists? Everybody does it for about 3 days after you finish watching it.
Well, look, everybody's been that teenager where music is that important to you that you have to have top fives or mixtapes or anything like that. Mm. And that's the biggest, most relatable part of this film, I think.
Absolutely.
Is we've all been there. And us as filmies, like, we make top five lists all the time for certain genre films. What's your favourite Western? What's your favourite sci-fi?
Yep. I'm making one right now.
What are you doing?
No, top five. Can't tell you.
top five.
Top five Elder Kingdoms. We've all been there.
Top five.
And let's talk about
Cody scripts.
Genius.
Don't poke the bear, Jared.
I want to quickly touch on the fact that Harold Ramis and Beverly D'Angelo were in deleted scenes from the film.
That's true.
I mean, that's the kind of talent you would think that they would put in the film.
Yeah.
But to leave that on the cutting room floor shows a lot of integrity.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's brave.
That they can do without it because it just won't benefit the story or the flow. Those scenes are good.
Oh my God, that Beverly D'Angelo scene, I'd never watched the deleted scenes before tonight. And that scene in particular was fucking great. So much chemistry, on-screen chemistry.
She is a stone-cold Fox.
was. Cool. Do you have anything else you want to add to it?
No, that is all.
I will add the one thing. I think the closing scene for High Fidelity is one of my favorite closing scenes of all time, where he just flicks the radio on and spins his chair. Amazing. Because I always get the tingles, you know, when he does it.
Yeah.
And then the music lifts and the credits come on. Oh, Frampton, isn't it?
Frampton, yeah.
Yeah.
Frampton.
Amazing. Love it. I believe when I fall in love with you, it will be forever. So now we're up to our obscurity. And interesting talking about High Fidelity, I've just realised that mine kind of fits in that mould, because you, Sean, talked about High Fidelity appealing to more of a sort of the men, you know, breaks convention, and it's not so much a chick flick as opposed to just a, you know, multi-sex sort of film.
Right.
This one's the same. It comes from the guy's perspective.
Can we play the guessing game again?
If you want to, I can just tell you what
have
it
you
is.
Have you seen his screen?
No. Okay, good. I'm wearing my glasses. I can't even see you.
I can't even see the fucking microphone.
All right, have a guess. I doubt you'll get it. It's obscure.
Bad Johnson.
No, but you can hear the What the Fuck Was That podcast all about Bad Johnson. That's one of the worst films I've ever seen.
Really?
Yep.
Good.
Soon you'll be able to buy one of the Blu-rays from the Fake Shemp website.
That's true. Two copies.
Good. All right, go. What's your film?
Okay, it's called Sleepwalk With Me. Have you heard of it or seen it?
Oh, no. You're telling me about this one. I got it in my Netflix queue.
Yeah, this is a great little film. It's a it's directed by a guy called Mike Birbiglia, I think is how you pronounce his name. You might recognize his face. He's a stand-up comedian in America. And he directed, wrote the film. It's based on a off-Broadway show that he did, like a one-man show. And it's a film... It kind of takes place a bit like Seinfeld, where he has that intercut with live stand-up comedy.
Right.
Telling his story, and then it cuts to the actual story.
Kind of like Louis C.K. as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
It's all about the breakdown of a relationship he's having, and he doesn't really want to fix it. Like, it's a weird, unconventional story in that, you know, the audience really wants this to work out, but he doesn't really care, you know, and he's sort of working out what's wrong with him, what's wrong with her, and it's that kind of break of convention that makes it really refreshing.
Mm.
And the love interest, if you can call it that, is Lauren Ambrose. Do you know her from 6 Feet Under?
I was going to say the name rings a bit. Ah, yes, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
And it's all about his anxieties, his inability to accept the progression of the relationship. And it's just a really, really refreshing, immensely satisfying film. And I highly recommend it to anyone.
And this is fairly recent.
I was going to say, what year did it come out?
2012.
Yeah, oh, wow, really?
Probably hit Australia more 2013.
Right.
Yeah, but just really, really good. Very funny, very dry. I keep saying it, but breaks the convention in every way it can. Yeah, so really, really, really recommend that one.
Is it easy to get your hands on?
Oh, it's always Madman.
I was going to say Madman put it out. I think on DVD only.
Yeah.
So I would definitely try seeking that. You said you got on your Netflix queue?
Yeah.
It's easily on Netflix.
Yeah.
It's on Netflix.
Yeah. Yeah, it might be Netflix US, but I'm
But I would love
it's one
would
of the regions.
To know someone that's seen it that I can have this discussion with, because I really, really dig it. And the way that, like I said, High Fidelity has that whole male-centric kind of aspect. Combine that with Seinfeld and Louis C.K., even Manny Lewis sort of has
What I don't want to bring up an old one, but this is exactly what I was thinking of. Yeah. It sounds like Manny Lewis.
Only different kind of relationship story.
Yeah,
but definitely infusing his comedy into the story, his stand-up and the actual narrative. Very, very clever. Really well worth a look. So.
Seems to be an ever-growing trend, that kind of blurring the lines of reality, like what's happening, what's not happening. It's an interesting...
I think it's just trying to breathe new life into a stale kind of genre, I think. And to me, I like it. I don't always like it. I watched Punchline recently, which is obviously very old with Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
And what it doesn't
was that,
work 80, at all.
86 or something?
Does not work at all in that film. The comedy's stale. It's just... Yeah.
Even that Nick Cave one, that sort of blurring the lines documentary, that 20,000 Days on Earth, that was the same. That was quite innovative in the way it utilized the form. But
at the same time, it didn't resonate with me because I couldn't tell fantasy from fiction in that film.
Sure.
Right.
I wanted something that I was able to get a glimpse of his real life, which there's plenty of in there, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But so much of it was staged.
Of course.
Especially going to, what's his fiddler's name? Ellis...
David Ellis.
Warren Ellis.
He goes to Warren Ellis' house for a cup of coffee or a cup of tea. it's such a staged moment that the reality's broken for me. You know, it just doesn't feel real. So I do like these films trying to challenge what we know about certain things, but they've got to be careful in how they toe the line. There's got to be an element of convention still.
It's got to be anchored somewhere in reality.
So Sleepwalk With Me, highly recommended. I will just, an honorable mention, I was going to choose one called, oh, I just lost it.
That is really obscure.
That is the most obscure, Splinterheads. Which is the film that got me stuck on geocaching, which is a hobby I do.
Yeah.
And this is a rom-com with Rachel Taylor. And it's all about geocaching and falling in love while you're out there doing that. So that was going to be my choice.
That sounds fucking obscure.
I don't even know what a
very fucking funny.
I don't even know what geocaching is.
You can Google that later.
We'll get into that at another time.
Yep.
That'll be on our geocaching special.
Yeah. We'll be discussing films and geocaching in general. Splinterheads being the only
the only one I've seen. It's appealing to a very specific audience.
Jared.
Okay, so I had sort of a similar issue. I chose a film, then rewatched it, and realized maybe there really wasn't any romance in it. It was Miranda July's film, The Future, from 2011. I love Miranda July. She's coming out in Australia. She's coming to do a talk about her new book in March, going to Sydney and here in Melbourne. Rewatched it, and just there's no real romance about it. It's about taking a break in a relationship, but I somewhat remember it having a happier ending. Spoiler alert.
I haven't seen it, but
I know.
Damn,
just nice one.
It's been 5 years, gents. Come on. So I chose a little film from 1987 called Morgan Stewart's Coming Home, which is also known as Homefront in the UK, and is available on DVD in Australia under the title Homefront. Maybe out of print now. John Cryer playing Morgan Stewart, and it's very similar to Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Which I've never heard of it.
Okay, well, let me tell you a little bit about the
John Hughes film. Matthew Broderick.
I like that. Yeah, nicely well played.
Did you see the look in my face there? I'm just like, wait, doesn't Ferret? No, well done, arsehole.
See the disdain.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is the brief synopsis. At the request of his parents, Morgan returns home from boarding school to spend Thanksgiving with them. However, Morgan learns the invitation has more of a political agenda than a loving one, as his father is running for senator and his advisor has suggested a family image is the go. Living under the family rule proves difficult for Morgan, particularly once he falls head over heels for Emily, a girl he meets at a George Romero bookstore signing.
Good.
Of course, against all odds and his parents' best wishes, he pursues romance with Emily. It's just a fun, like, it really is just a fluffy kind of romance. More, you know, a comedy than anything
else.
What
year was it?
1987. I think.
You can't go wrong with 87 John Cryer. Like anything 80s John Cryer.
Perfect. It's like Hiding Out era, Pretty in Pink era John Cryer. Which, you know, it's...
What's the name of it?
Morgan Stewart's Coming Home, also known as Homefront.
Right, so there was this spate of films around them with those long titles like Welcome Home, Roxy Carmichael.
Yeah, it was about 91, but yeah, I was going to say that exact same thing. Yeah, that has that similar sort of long title. The thing I find that makes this film sort of special to me is that as a kid, I obviously had an affinity with Morgan because he was such a horror nerd.
There's
posters draped across his walls. In fact, the opening shot of the film is pulling away from Lucio Fulci's zombie poster, which is very cool.
So
the idea that there was a girl out there that was a bit of a horror nerd too, I thought, well, that's fucking cool.
Yeah.
Does this exist? Like, obviously not in Queensland at that time.
Good.
it does play out as a bit of a poor man's, you know, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, but it's a fun, romantic, coming-of-age sort of yarn that's, you know, really for anyone that likes 80s teen comedies.
There you go.
Yeah, schmaltzy but fun.
I have no idea why I haven't seen it.
No, I know, I'm the same. It sounds really intriguing.
It's not even under my radar. Like, I mean, I know John Cryer.
Completely off the radar.
Completely.
Yeah. Predates Hiding Out, I think, by about a year. Yeah.
Well,
because I think it was produced in about 85, 86, might have been shelved.
Do you know who directed all of that's off?
Yes, I do actually.
Yeah.
Alan Smithy.
Was it really?
Yeah, it was the director got pulled off the project, then they hired another director to come on board who directed the last three quarters of the film, but wasn't happy with the final result and didn't want his name on it. So yeah, it's
clearly
an Alan Smithy film.
Yeah.
Clearly Jesus. You were happy with it.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up because I forgot about it. I remember the opening credits coming up and I'm like, yeah.
Good.
Very cool. But yeah, that's mine. Sean?
Mine is a little film from 1988, directed by a guy called Steve DeJarnett. And he'd only done one other film before then called Cherry 2000, right?
Yes. Oh, I know what it is.
Okay.
I actually chose this as my obscurity on a previous podcast.
Did you really?
I did.
What is it?
No.
Miracle Mile?
Miracle Mile.
I did this, did I not?
Yeah, you did.
There you go.
Awesome.
I absolutely
so
love it.
So we've had this discussion.
Film.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah.
I'm thinking I did. I'm not 100% now.
Where did you see it? Because it is exceptionally fucking difficult to
Yeah, well, I saw it on video, obviously, when it first came out back in the day. I only learned recently it did play theatrically
in
Australia.
Anthony Edwards?
Did it really? Yeah, Anthony Edwards. And Mary Wingham.
But no, I tracked it down on Netflix, somewhere like Netflix Mexico.
Oh, wow.
But it's just been released on Blu-ray late last year in the US through Kina Lorber, who put out Cherry 2000.
So,
as well.
Yeah. So for those who haven't listened,
it's about a young guy in LA who he's a trumpet player, and he meets this woman in a cafe, and instantly they fall in love, right? They agree to meet the next day, and he sleeps in. And he gets to the meeting place a couple hours too late, and then he tries to phone her and she doesn't answer, and he thinks that's it, blew it with the most perfect woman on planet Earth. Now this is 10 minutes into the film, right? It is exceptionally efficient, it moves like lightning, and instantly you just buy the chemistry between these two, right? As he hangs up the phone, he goes to walk away, the phone rings, and he turns around, thinks it's her, and he picks up the phone, and it's a guy on the other side, and says, the missiles have been launched, you have to get out of there. A nuke is gonna hit LA and you've got 70 minutes before it lands. And he doesn't know if it's a hoax or if it's not. And all he thinks is that if it is, I have to find this girl and I have to get her out of the city. And the next 70 minutes of the film takes place in real time. It's a little bit The Day After Tomorrow. It's a little bit
These final hours.
Yeah, and it's a little bit Martin Scorsese's After Hours, right?
Yeah.
And even to a degree, you can even see the influence that it left on Shaun of the Dead. And it is one of the most romantic, because this guy moves heaven and earth to try and get his hands on this woman. If you haven't seen it, please do yourself a favor. It is so worthwhile tracking
down. Well, sir, that was much better description than Jarrett gave us on the last
episode. Now I'm thinking I actually didn't choose it as an obscurity.
Really?
We talked about it.
I think I watched it on New Year's Eve. Not this year, just gone, but the previous year. It was the one I watched at the stroke of midnight.
It was a rapid fire discussion, I reckon.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, back
right.
when we did that.
Back in the day.
But it has been discussed
there
and
you
did it better. So.
There you go.
I probably got 3 seconds because he cut me off.
And it's a
fire.
Don't do that anymore. It's a real shame because Steve DeJarn, he proves to be a real talent. And even
what
the
happened?
Film, I have no idea because he didn't really do it. He sort of mucked around in TV for a little bit since then. I mean, it's been pushing 30 years now and he sort of directs episodes here and there. Mm. But really, this guy, this film sets him up for a really good career, and then he just never capitalized on it. It's such a solid premise to the film as well, that originally, I was reading on IMDb, that it originally was considered to be a segment on the Twilight Zone movie.
Right.
Because it's very kind of, and when you say that, you're like, oh, it's very Twilight Zone. You can see the similarities, and like, it was dropped eventually, obviously.
So has he gone on to anything aside from directing as far as like, in other roles?
Yeah, I mean, like, he's a writer, but even then, I think over the course of the last 30 years, he actually has, like, 9 writing credits.
Right.
He's a bit of a Fred Decker. He is a bit of a Fred Decker,
made
you're right.
Two
yeah.
exceptional sort of films,
two
you know, in the 80s.
Films.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then subsequently was, you know, did a lot of TV work, but never really
but the
made
funny
it a massive
thing is, like,
feature.
Speaking of, like, this as a subject, and Fred Decker, we interviewed him on the website, and I posed the question something along the lines of, you know, well, you know, what have you been doing over the years? Which is kind of an offensive question to ask.
Yeah.
And he just said, well, I've been working.
Yeah.
You know, like, I still in the filmmaking business. Yeah. You know? So, just because it doesn't come under our radar, even it doesn't even have to register on IMDb. There's a lot of stuff that
doesn't
even.
No, you could be anything from script doctoring to directing TVCs
and these people,
to, you know.
These people have comfortable careers in filmmaking.
Oh, yeah,
they don't have to be directing or writing.
I think it's just heartbreaking because you have like a visionary, say like Steven or Fred, who have made these films in the 80s that I think, you know, at the time, they were popular but not massive, but have gone on to become
huge,
massive cult films.
Yeah. They've endured,
and then and then you're just like, okay, well, I think you were undervalued at that point in time, but now you're heralded as a hero.
Okay, but then you could look at the flip side of that, and directors that could have had the same thing, someone like Jim Wynorski, who have continued to make films, but they've gotten worse and worse. Started off with those films that are cult classics like Chopping Mall and...
They were never really in the vein of these.
No, I mean, like, the principle stands, but even
I heard
if
that
the
guy's
quality...
an asshole anyway.
Yeah.
You can't say that.
You totally
he is.
No, I'm like,
yeah.
No.
We all see.
Read the interview on our website.
Yeah.
But yeah,
he's not listening to this. He never will.
Yeah, but he, Steve DeGiannet, he actually ended up teaming up with Anthony Edwards again, directed a couple episodes of ER, then he did Nash Bridges, then he did the Lizzie McGuire TV show. And like, so, I mean, like, he is working.
Yeah, yeah.
But even then, I think, you know, his credits are, for a guy who shows such talent and such promise, I mean, like, TV, Lizzie McGuire show is just, is below.
No, but I mean, that's work, man. And,
yeah, I mean, like, it pays the bills. Like,
yeah, exactly, yeah.
And that essentially is what filmmaking is.
And fuck, I'd rather be directing some Lizzie McGuire than maybe doing what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Get to work with Robert Carradine.
Yeah, there's that. Yeah,
there is that. There is that.
Yeah.
So.
Anyway, well, cool. That was some good choices.
Some tasty there were obscurities.
I like this one because, Jared, you listened to the brief this time and you actually chose an obscurity.
Yes. Why? What, you don't think my films are obscure enough?
Well, wasn't it last time? No, like,
that was Forgotten that Gem was thinner.
Thinner. Ah, was it? Sorry. Excuse
They're very,
me.
Very
Excuse
similar me. To Forgotten
Ooh,
Gem.
The claws are out. Tom Holland. There's another director that we can talk about in the same boat.
Yeah.
You know, like, made these great films back then. Mm. These days, he's running on the fumes of those films.
Toby Hooper.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely.
They could just go on and on.
Have you seen Gin?
No, I haven't seen it.
I haven't.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Let's leave it there before we say anything stupid.
Let's see.
See that? That was like that was
really deep throated. That.
That was the whole microphone at once.
Oh. That was amazing. Something tells me that he's done this before.
What a fucking ass.
I wish we were recording that.
We were.
We've got really?
That on. Yeah.
Oh, good.
Just on audio though.
Every fucking time.
I should have had this.
Yeah.
I used to know when these Kodak moments will happen.
It's late.
And that brings us to another end of an episode.
I'm sad.
Why's that?
Well, yeah, because I always, to be fair, I love doing this.
This is all I live for.
And yeah, if I don't have this, I will kill myself. That's not true.
Every 3 weeks is not enough for sure.
No.
Don't look at me like that. Well, it's like, no, it does. It makes me sad. I like when the episode's over. It's all good. It's all done.
Is there anything coming up that's worth noting?
Deadpool.
Yes, the review for Deadpool, which is probably already available on the website.
No, but, it's not. You
know, no, by the time this maybe goes up.
Are you pretending like we're live?
Well, no. Like, I mean, by the time that this goes live, it'll already be up on the website.
He's right. You know, if you go and look at the website right now, at this very moment. Not yesterday when we recorded, but this very moment now.
Okay, this is
probably already
too,
up there.
This is getting too mad.
This is like Inception, man. It's like inside.
There's Macaulay Culkin in the corner of the room. Yeah. He's crying now. But
Deadpool. Yeah. Deadpool's obviously the big one. Deadpool. Coming out February 11th. Ryan Reynolds' second stab at a superhero movie after the appalling Green Lantern.
And R.I.P.D.
All right,
which Blade did
I liked it. I didn't like it, but I liked it.
It was okay.
And Blade Trinity.
Well, to be honest, I mean, Blade Trinity wasn't really his film, was it, really?
Well, it's a comic book adaptation, plus he was...
I'm going to beat you with this microphone in a minute. It's his leading role in...
No, look, I'll say that he probably was the draw card for number three, Blade.
I agree. If it wasn't for him, it would be fucking next unwatchable. Like,
And now, the Critics Awards... Tell us a bit about that, Glenn. That's coming up.
Oh, we've got the Australian Film Critics Association Awards. They're coming up. February 16th. Yeah. I don't know what to say about it. Like, I've not been to one before.
Should be interesting.
Looking forward to it. And the films that are up for nominations, obviously Australian films.
Excellent.
I think Mad Max will take this one, I think, easily.
Yeah.
Easily. If I'm sort of gauging the sentiments amongst critics, I think Mad Max...
It's going to be Mad Max and the Dressmaker.
Dressmaker's is gonna, close runner-up.
Yeah.
Don't think it'll take it.
No buzz for now at Honey. No,
good.
No buzz. I wish not.
Robin Butler was the woman that wrote that one.
The other one is holding the Man.
Oh yeah. I really want to see this. Yeah, I just got on Blu-ray this week.
Yeah,
what I've given it.
Last Cab to Darwin.
Are these
all in?
Yeah, they're all in competition.
Gone Lesbo Gone, The Untold Tale of an Unseen Film. That didn't
I
get a nomination.
You know what? Look, the thing is, I was part of the all of the film critics that are part of the association were part of the process of throwing nominations out there.
Mm.
In the very first selective process, I threw Manny Lewis in the ring because I thought,
yeah, absolutely,
this film needs the recognition.
Yeah.
But that's not made the
that's a shame.
List, which is a shame. But it'll be interesting. I don't think there's much There's no question it's going to be good. Mad Max or Dressmaker. Simple as that. So it'd be interesting. But there's also awards for film criticism.
Right, excellent.
So it'd be interesting to see who takes away some of those awards.
It's going
to
be me, obviously.
Maybe.
Maybe. Yeah, good.
Have you reviewed any Australian film?
That will be the fucking surprise of the year.
Wildcard.
Yeah.
Anyway, a film critic who I think will walk away with stuff is a guy named Luke Buckmaster.
Right.
He writes for, I think, The Australian. He used to work for Crikey.
Right.
Great reviews, and he's really done a lot of belters recently. So, since 2016 Clocked Over, he's watched 100 films. Like, he made a point of making
God!
He set himself a task, which is on the... could be The Australian's website, where he's going to challenge himself to watch 100 films in 1 month. And he's done it, and he's done reviews, and yeah.
Wow.
To be fair, is being a film reviewer his job?
Yes, full-time film critic for The Australian. That makes sense. Yeah.
Because, okay. I mean, like, the most films I've watched in a three-week period was for us, and I think, what did I top? I topped out at, like, 52 or something in the month, but I worked full-time, and that was a fucking push.
Mm. Well, so watching 100... And these films weren't all for work. I mean, he did a lot of rewind films, so he went back and watched classics that he'd never seen before and sort of just gave a bit of a diary up to date with whatnot. But he went head-to-head with Tarantino on video, on camera for Hateful Eight.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think he'll come away with something. He's won it before, you know, back in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
He's great. You know, I reckon you should check out his work. But
okay,
for sure. Anyway, so there's that. What else have we got? We've got a collection update for January. Should be hopping up.
Yeah. I've been working on that. My voice is back now, and I've got hearing in my left ear, so any day now.
You know, the collection updates that Jarrett puts up on YouTube are one of our biggest draw cards. They get thousands of clicks.
Very unusual.
It is very unusual.
It's really unusual. But I did tell you that I got a message via Facebook, and I hadn't noticed because it went into that others folder.
Yeah.
And I finally found that others folder.
Damn other folder!
And there was a couple of messages from different folk, but there was one dude that's like, I watch your collection updates all the time. I just wanted you to know that I enjoy them. Please keep making them. And I'm like, oh, well, that's fucking...
You know what, they're
that's
good.
Really,
and it was like
sweet.
From a couple months ago, and I responded going, oh, I'm really sorry, I only just read this now. Hopefully you're still watching. You know, thanks for your support.
That's
never
really
heard
sweet.
From them, though. It's probably it is others' fault.
No, now. Full credit to you, because they are fantastic. I've watched a lot of collection updates. Yours are far more entertaining than any I've watched.
Yeah,
I love the fact on the last one, Archibald made a fantastic cameo.
Creepy cameo.
Oh my god, I laughed like you can't believe.
I like to throw those in because you think, is anyone still watching at the 15-minute mark? And you throw something like that in, and Glenn says, how about that Archibald? You're like, oh yeah, he made it.
Okay,
he made it.
For those listening, Archibald is...
He's my little pet pug. My 6-year-old, 5-year-old pug going on 6.
And every now and then, like, you hear scratching in the background when Jared's
in,
or you
hear some heavy breathing, that's me.
Yeah.
Gnawing at a bone. Yep, that's me again.
And of course, next week, Sean is going head to head with Paul W.S. Anderson to discuss Resident Evil 6. So, looking forward to that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What was
a fabrication.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
That was a complete lie.
Wait, are you going to be in the same room? Can you kill him?
Can you kill him? Did you know?
Bit much.
He is the most successful British director of all time.
Doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, honestly.
Not Stephen Frears.
His movies have made more money in a global box office than any British director in history.
See, he did the Alien vs. Predator films too, yeah?
Well, he did the first one.
Although,
the first one. I haven't watched the second
one.
Really,
and he's done Death... He's written, produced the Death Race films. Directed the first one. He did all the Resident Evils, obviously. He did Three Musketeers.
Paranoia.
Pandora.
His films are genre.
He has some stiff competition though, because Hitchcock was quite a master.
Yeah, there's that.
Yeah, but like, there's a difference between financially profitable and a great director. So
true.
Yeah. That is a good point. Cool. Mm. All right, well, that's about it for us. We could babble on all night. Maybe we'll do that, and we'll have it like a episode 23 redo. No.
Oh, I'm down for it. Anything that's going to help this guy out, because otherwise he might be upset.
Oh, then
he needs it.
How about, why don't we just say goodbye and we'll crack those beers?
Done.
Done.
You got to kick it off with a killer to grab attention. Then you got to take it up a notch. But you don't want to blow your wad, so then you got to cool it off a notch. There are a lot of rules. Anyway, I've started to make a tape in my head for Laura. Full of stuff she'd like. Full of stuff that would make her happy. For the first time, I can sort of see how that's done.
I believe when I fall in love with you, it won't be forever. I believe when I fall in love this time, it won't be forever.